Welcome to Neurotransmissions, neuroscience stories from the lab and life, by scientists, for everyone. Your hosts today are Drs. Misha Smirnov, Joe Schumacher, and Ben Scholl.
Welcome to the second episode of Neurotransmissions. I'm your host, Ben. With me is Joe.
Yo.
And Misha.
Hello.
All right, well, today's the connectomics episode. We're going to be talking to Jeff Lichtman from Harvard University about how the brain is wired up.
So the first time I saw Jeff Lichtman speak was a few years back when he was giving a presidential lecture at the Society for Neuroscience conference. This is a conference with 30,000 people, and he is talking to an auditorium of essentially all of them. And he's talking about connectomics, which is what we'll be discussing later today. And this is the idea that you can have an actual wiring diagram of the brain. And it made me realize, as I saw it, that things are so much more complex than we as neuroscientists commonly think. We think that there's a path of neurons, one is connected to the other, and they form a circuit. But in reality, it's way more complicated and way more insane. And I can't wait to hear more about that.
Right. And just to clarify one point about what connectomics actually is. Think about a lot of the really big endeavors of science over the last couple decades, genomics, proteomics. These are fields that are dedicated to sequencing entire genomes or classes of proteins. In the case of connectomics, we're really talking about people coming up with comprehensive wiring diagrams of the brain and at really fine scales, at synaptic scales. So let's talk to Jeff Lichtman about his work and find out all about connectomics. So today we're sitting down with Dr. Jeff Lichtman. He's the Jeremy R. Knowles Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology at Harvard University. Dr. Lichtman, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here.
Dr. Lichtman, thank you so much for talking to us. You work in a field that is right now, I think, would be considered to a lot of people the forefront of neuroscience. And we would love to hear about connectomics and your work in it. But first, how did you get to where you are? You came from grad school like the rest of us, but now you are working in this incredibly exciting field. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm glad to hear you think it's an exciting field and not a idiotic, stupid, terrible field, which some of my colleagues think. So you're already on my side. You're
great.
My friend, right. My best friend.
We're cozying up yes. to you right off the bat.
This interview is going very well.
Yeah.
I think most scientists who have gray hair who are still scientists will tell you that they don't make any real strategic decisions about what to study. It's all quite natural. Quite intentional, basically following a particular idea to its conclusion. And certainly when I was a graduate student, I wasn't thinking about connectomics. But if I look back at what I did as a graduate student, it was, for me, the beginning of this particular line of thought. And this is just the logical extension of that. And I can't imagine what it will be in 20 or 30 years, but I certainly feel it's quite a natural transition from where I was as a graduate student. My interest has always been related to thinking about the nervous system and its developmental dynamism as we learn and change from a blob of protoplasm that has a brain that has great capabilities but knows nothing about the world, that's the human brain at birth pretty much, to the remarkable organs we have as adults. I've always thought that if we want to understand how that transition occurs, we're going to have to think about the nervous system as a society of cells, and that these cells are somehow self-organizing into a highly functional design. And when you think of it that way, then you have to pay attention to each cell as an individual entity. And that was part of my research as a graduate student, part of my research as a postdoc, and progressively more and more of my research as I had my own lab. And so connectomics is just the extension of that idea.
And so, you know, generally speaking, connectomics is getting at this question of the broader organization that you're talking about, looking at the entire society of cells from across all brain regions, mapping the entire thing. How does one go about doing that? How do you start, you know, a lot of neuroscientists study things down to individual ion channels, and some people study action potentials from individual cells. It seems like quite a leap to go into suddenly being able to map the entire brain of an animal. So how, what are some of the ways that you can actually start to do that?
Yeah, I think mapping the entire brain of an animal is quite a challenge. And I think if that animal is a human, it is still an inapproachable goal. I could say that I'm not convinced that one has to do the entire animal. It's a little different from genomics, where if you miss a chromosome, you know, you're really not going to have the full story. Connectomics is perhaps less interesting in the sense that there is probably a certain amount of structure to the wiring diagram one needs to know, where anything you learn additionally by adding more information would just reassert what you've already learned. At some point, it would get boring. And I don't know at what point that is. It's certainly not at 1,000 cubic microns. Our next big hurdle will be a cubic millimeter. It may be that'll be enough. That'll be a whole cortical thickness. I doubt it. But it may not require doing a whole hemisphere or a whole brain before you say, okay, now I've got it. I think there's a mistaken notion that somehow every cell has a unique function, like every gene might have a unique function. And therefore, if you don't have everything, you'll never understand the system. You just should forget about understanding the system. You'll never understand the system, period. I don't think that's the goal of this. It's more to get an understanding of a more macro level of what the organization of neural circuits is, about which we know next to nothing, to be honest.
So it's really about getting general organizational principles rather than an entire map of the overall
thought patterns in somebody's individual brain.
Yeah, I mean, we have, remember, with C. elegans, have a relatively good map. It's not perfect, but a relatively good map of an adult C. elegans. It's actually an amalgam of several animals. And that is an animal where every single cell has a separate function, and every cell has been evolved with a very particular evolutionary idea in mind. In the case of a mammalian brain, which is where I started, I think thinking about how mammalian brains acquire information about the world, you have a very different organization of the brain. You have the same kind of cell over and over and over again. So although each cell might ultimately be wired slightly differently, the functional insight into how they vary might come by looking at 100 of them rather than like looking at 100 million Purkinje cells.
So what are kind of, do you think, the barriers currently that you're dealing with your research? I mean, you're talking about how a piece of the mammalian brain, at least right now, is more realistic than doing the whole brain. What are the technologies that you can use, and what are the technologies that you don't have that you feel like you need?
Yeah, so the goal of connectomics is to get the connectional map at the resolution of every synapse. At least that's my definition of it. And we can now do that for what seem to me like large data sets, but are actually minuscule parts of the brain. We are gearing up to do ever larger volumes. So I don't think any of that is going to hold us back. I believe we can do large volumes, and it's only money, to be honest now, that restricts the amount we can do. Because of the style of science we do, where we first cut the brain and put the sections on wafers, means that the speed of throughput is related simply to the number of electron microscopes I can buy. So, you know, if I had 1 million electron microscopes, I could do a human brain in one day or a half a day.
What is an electron microscope, and why do they need an electron microscope to do this connectomic stuff?
All right. Well, imagine the stereotypical kind of microscope that you would have in a laboratory, right? The kind of thing where you look through two little eyepieces and you see some some kind of fluorescent little cells down there, you know, where you're basically just zooming in.
It's just a little magnification.
Just a little magnification, right? It's essentially a bunch of little lenses. And the thing about them is you're using light waves. So when you use light waves, there is a fundamental resolution that you actually can't really break. And the wonderful thing about electron microscopes is that instead of light waves, which are relatively large. You use electrons, which are very, very small. Now, the nice thing about this is that you could see things that are way, way, way smaller than you would be able to see with a light microscope. And of course, there are a lot of downsides. So for example, you can't have different colors or anything like that, because colors essentially don't exist on the electron scale, because electrons are much smaller than light waves. But for the kind of research that Jeff is talking about, you need to have very, very small resolution or very, very high resolution information to be able to see the exact connections and the molecules that are moving in between the actual cells you're looking at.
I gotcha. So an electron microscope allows you to zoom into a level that you can't see just by looking at light. And in order to visualize things happening on the scale of neurons or subcellular
processes. Things, microns, things that are nanometers in size.
Cool, gotcha.
So it's just that now. So I don't think there's any real limitation to generating the data. The next big step is turning the images, which are relatively useless data, into segmented wires. And that can be done manually, but that's slow, and you would have to use, I would say, millions of human beings if you wanted to do that at a reasonable speed. I don't think that's going to happen. Some of my colleagues, I think, are more hopeful that maybe they can get enough people, like everyone who has a cell phone in Korea is Sebastian Sung's, I think, hope, perhaps, that everyone would participate in this. Mm-hmm.
He's crowdsourcing.
That's great.
Connectivity, yeah.
Yeah. But I think once you have enough human experience doing this, you have a lot of training data for learning algorithms. And that is the direction my colleagues and I are going in, where we're taking very detailed human tracings and using that as a learning tool to try to get computers to imitate human beings.
And so essentially what you're doing is you have computers figure out how to stitch together all these images to actually create these 3D wiring diagrams.
Right. The first step is to stitch them together, both in plane and between planes. And then the second step is to what we call segment it, which is like coloring in each wire as it goes from section to section. And the computers are doing all that. It's all being done on clusters now. And more of it we're trying to push over from CPU clusters to GPU clusters, which are smaller but more powerful. Right. And again, the hope is we eventually get to a point where the only thing that stands in the way is the amount of compute power you have, that it's not a fundamental intellectual problem anymore. It's just a matter of how many computer operations you can do per pixel per second.
So say once you've gotten to the point where you have this ideal computer with a massive GPU array and everything, and you can have a three-dimensional map of all these connections, how are we going to interact with it? What's the end goal of how we can use this for our research?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got billions of connections in front of you, right? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, I guess in a related question, just to put it in perspective, if I had a cubic millimeter of Cortex, how much hard drive space would that take up?
Okay, so let's start with the numbers. We anticipate a cubic millimeter will be 2,000 terabytes, 2 petabytes, and it'll have about a billion synapses in it. And that project is beginning this week, actually.
Wow.
The funding has just started for that. I think the main concern is, what do you do with this? Well, first, I should say that if you interview neuroscientists, whether they work on the amygdala or the cortex or Drosophila or the worm, and ask them what they're interested in, they say they're interested in the neural circuits they're studying. And
right.
One way or another, they're interested in that. And yet none of them, except for a few people who deal with the adult C. elegans, have access to this kind of data. It would be nice to have tools so that everyone, rather than just a few people, have access to this data. And then why? Well, ask them why they're interested in neural circuits. There must be many, many different reasons for that.
Sure.
But I think you maybe are hitting upon the supreme challenge here, and the one that I'm most interested in, because it is a fundamentally interesting and ironic challenge, which is, we are doing this with this hope that once we have this data, we will have some deep insight into how brains work. We will understand them. The problem is that the way brains work in all animals, as far as I know, is that in parallel, many, many things are happening simultaneously. And through their interactions, excitation and inhibition, recurrent loops, all sorts of inhibition and excitation, through all of this stuff, outcome behavioral outputs from sensory inputs. That is not how you and I think, however. We think very much in a causal, analytical way where A causes B to happen and B causes C to happen. We don't think, well, there's 5 million A's, each going in different directions, and they're hitting 5 billion B's, and some of them are feeding back on A's. We don't think that way. And yet that's the way our brains work to give us thought.
So in order for us to experience the world, we don't necessarily have to be conscious of how circuits in the brain are processing information.
And this, I think, is the fundamental problem, that it's not going to be easy or trivial or perhaps even possible for humans to end up in saying, I understand how the brain is doing this, any more than they understand the stock market, the weather, or New York City, where you have many things happening simultaneously.
So we'll be able to look in the microcosm, but you think the macro picture, at least understanding a macro picture for a person, is kind of even theoretically outside of
it's elusive.
Possibility.
Yes. Right. And I would say, thinking about fields like quantum mechanics, where even the architects of that field say you just can't be rational about it. You can come up with a theory that is giving you the right answers you expect and that you always get the right answer, but you don't understand it because, again, quantum mechanics like this, although quantum mechanics is vastly simpler than the brain, millions of things are happening simultaneously, generating a probability distribution that gives you an output. That's not very different from what's happening in brains, except there's all this extra stuff related to genetics and what a particular animal or human being learned that makes it very particular in one case, in ways that are hard to understand. It's not as pure and clean as quantum mechanics, but it's got the same fundamental problem.
So when I see a TED Talk that says, you are your connectome, to what extent do you think that is true? To what extent do you think that a person's self or consciousness is tied up in the perhaps consciousness is a dirty word here, but how much of that can be accounted for in the architecture that you get from a connectomics perspective?
I guess the question is, what else is in there besides the wiring diagram? When you look at the wiring diagram, you are impressed with how much wiring there actually is. You are at least partly your connectome. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, if you got rid of all those wires, you wouldn't be anything. But is the density of sodium and potassium channels and the particular subset of those channels on each particular nerve cell also a part of who you are? Absolutely. And some of that stuff is just not visible in electron microscopy. That's just showing you who's connected to who. So I'm sure that a lot of what you know about the world, the words you know in your vocabulary, how to play piano or type, those things must be at some level related to what nerve cells are connected to what other nerve cells. Your memories are probably instantiated in the wiring of the brain. And so in that sense, a large part of who you are is somehow put in through the wiring, through a developmental process that gives you a very unique wiring diagram relative to me.
Right. So you have a long-standing research interest in development. And it seems that from a basic science perspective, not just in terms of pushing the boundaries of what we can do with our advanced computational and anatomical techniques, would be to ask questions about how the circuit logic forms in the first place, or what some of the changes that we see in development are. So have you begun to address those types of questions? And if so, is anything surprising you about what you're finding? Has this approach taken you in directions that perhaps you didn't expect to go in to begin with?
Yeah, I would say much of my research career has been focused on trying to find ways of watching the transition of the know-nothing baby brain into the highly knowledgeable but narrow-minded adult brain. Narrow-minded largely because my children tell me I'm narrow-minded. but Brainbow, for example, was the purpose of Brainbow was to see this phenomena, these phenomena occurring. The problem with Brainbow is that it's great for the peripheral nervous system, but in the central nervous system with the density of wiring, there was just too much wiring, and that's why we went to EM. So I would say all these, my own personal reason for doing this is entirely to do to the developing brain. But there's no point in doing the developing brain until you know what the end product is. You have to decide what is the goal of this at the wiring level. And so we started, for example, in the thalamus, where the adult we knew would be very simple, but we knew there was a lot of developmental reorganization. So we did the adult as a preface to do the development. And you asked me, has anything surprised us? And that the result of that study has already shocked us, which is the adult simple wiring diagram of the thalamus turned out to be impossibly complicated.
Wow. So you mentioned the Brainbow technique. I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for the audience. It's a fascinating trick to help you in your mapping of neural circuits. Maybe you could just describe how that helps you with this connectomics approach.
And how far it's gotten over the past couple of years, because it's gone on quite a bit of iterations.
Right. So the purpose of the segmentation step in electron microscopy is to take these wires and color them in each a different color. So we thought it might be interesting to just skip that step and just make a brain where every wire is already a different color. And that's not the hard, it's not as hard to do as you might imagine, because all the colors we can see are based on the reception of three basic colors, things in the red, green, and blue channels. So if you have a red color, a green color, and a blue color, and you can randomize the amount in each cell, then you can make every cell basically a different color. And that was the goal of Brainbow, and it worked. And then over the last couple of years, the Brainbow toolbox has improved. We now have a Brainbow virus. So if an animal is just a regular animal and it happens to have a Cre driver in it, or if you want to inject a Cre virus into the animal, you can make Brainbow in any animal you want, including your brain if you're interested.
Yeah, I hopefully will never get to the point of seeing the results of that, but I'm willing to be a test subject if it's... it's going to come down to that. So that's very cool. So you can actually map out the entire color spectrum across the brain, and it makes it easier to distinguish one wire from another when you're putting the thing back together.
Right. There's virtually zero significance to the color per se. The chartreuse wire doesn't mean anything other than that I know it's not the purple wire. So you can see where these different wires go. And we've used this to great effect in the peripheral nervous system, the real peripheral nervous system, the neuromuscular system and the autonomic nervous system, which is where I started and where my heart is still. I would like, though, because they're so simple there, the reorganizations that occur are much easier to see. You're dealing with a full deck rather than a very partial deck because all the wires are labeled and you know where every wire is coming from, whereas any piece of cortex or thalamus, there's always a lot of wires in there that are coming from places you're not sure where they're coming from. So, yeah.
So, to change track, switch track just a little bit, you mentioned your grants that are getting funded right now and the projects you're working on. So what you're working on is, I think a lot of people can very clearly link it to the Brain Initiative in general. I mean, you're mapping the brain, and so I was wondering how much a part that kind of how much a part the Brain Initiative in general is sort of funding and helping out your work, and how much the PR of it is helping you. I mean, the public is kind of getting interested seemingly in the brain and what we can finally do with it. You know, is this like the Human Genome Project for geneticists? Is that what this is like for you?
I wish. I was very pleased when I went to the WhiteHouse.gov site for the Brain Initiative and saw pictures, Brainbow picture after Brainbow picture. And I saw like a rainbow picture, and on top of it was the word $100 million. And on top of another one, another millions and millions of dollars. So I had assumed basically that the Brain Initiative would be a perfect place to fund this. That's what this is. These are new technologies to study the brain. But for reasons that are related, I'm sure, to the many, many interests that need to be dealt with in the Brain Initiative, the focus is not at all on this. This only can play a role in the Brain Initiative on studies where either there's a molecular mark of a different of each cell type, or studies in which there is activity monitoring of the same cells. The notion that you could learn anything from the structure per se is absolutely not anywhere in the Brain Initiative, and to my disappointment, I think. I believe that the structure of the brain is fundamental. It doesn't explain everything, of course, but it's not like it's useless knowledge. It's deeply informative knowledge, but I can't find grants in the Brain Initiative. And when people from the Brain Initiative talk to me, they say, oh, you're talking about the static connectome, as if there's something really wrong with this. I should remind you that the genomics is static. It's not the transcriptome. It's not telling you when genes are on. It's just telling you which genes are in the genome of an animal. No one says, oh, well, that's the static genome and we're not going to fund a genome. But when it comes to the connectome, that is the way people think. It's static and therefore dead and old and stupid. And I disagree, of course, but I'm telling you, Our big funding for this is coming from IARPA, mm-hmm. which is a very different part of the government.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm wondering if we could get a little bit crazy here for one second. Say you had, now I know that your goal is not to map out the entire human brain, but there have been a couple of really interesting think pieces in the New York Times lately that either say you can or cannot somehow upload yourself to a computer with the information that you have in a connectome. So I have a feeling I know where you stand on this, but if you could touch maybe slightly on that topic, I think it would be kind of funny to hear.
Yeah. I think this is a very popular and problematic question, including why would you want to do this? But I think there are some real fundamental problems between where we are and where you'd have to be before that would be useful. In the movies, what happens is you upload the brain and then you type into the keyboard and the brain talks to you back by sending you something on the computer screen in ASCII characters. And you just have to think about that for a moment. Where does your typing go into the connectome? How do you actually get that in? You don't have retinas built into this wiring diagram. You don't have the hair cells of the ear. Those end organs are very hard to synthesize. You just have a brain that's now disembodied from all the sensory input. But somehow, magically, the typing gets in.
Well, obviously the typing goes to a tiny printing press that actually writes a book and places it in front of a robotic eye to read.
But how does the robotic eye connect to the thalamus?
Well, I'm hoping that by the time we can upload our brain into a computer, right, we can make an iris that just goes, you could say, for example, directly into the, I don't know, retinal nerve and however that's being digitally represented.
Good luck on that.
Yeah, we actually have a startup company.
Fund us on
that? Sponsoring this podcast. Please?
Yeah, so I think that's one problem. I think the second problem is... by the time, you know, one idea here is that you'll do this so that your brain will last forever. And if it lasts forever, you'll be able to witness the world in a different time. Perhaps you could be sent out of space, out of space speed of light, and your connectome could land on another planet and you could be put back together. And wouldn't that be exciting? It would be about as exciting as it would be for a caveman being just brought to this table here and having him sit here and try to understand what we're
talking
about.
Absolutely terrifying is what you're saying.
And meaningless.
Right.
Because the whole, we assume the world has always been the way it is, but almost every assumption we make is based on our learning of growing up in this world. people who didn't grow up in this world would just find it impossibly barren and weird and difficult, no better than moving a dog into this room and asking it to enjoy being here with us. Only if you give it treats. And I think that's what would happen to people in this
situation. And I would imagine that the first step towards having a connectome uploaded to a computer would be kind of a half-assed connectome uploaded to a computer that's not entirely complete, which, who knows what that would be. It would probably just be computerized
typing, kill me.
Digital agony.
Right. And as I said, I have no idea how it would communicate with the world. It's one thing getting information in, but how do you get information out of that connectome? How does it type?
Right. Exactly. Well, on that philosophical note, we would just love to thank you for joining us today. It's been a really nice treat.
My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, that concludes episode 2 of the Neurotransmissions Podcast.
Thank you for listening.
And be sure to tune in to our future episodes. Thanks to our announcer, Vered Kellner, our producers in the Office of Scientific Communications, and everyone else at the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience who helped make this happen. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, at Neuropodcast. I'm at SaladZombie, Joe is at JWScience, and Ben doesn't actually exist. He's just my ventriloquist dummy.
I'm a real boy.